Following are comments on Shakespeare's Henry IV, Part 2, Act 4. I promised you redress of these same grievances whereof you did complain. Prince John hears the rebels' complaints, and promises all of them will be satisfied. When the rebel army disbands, John arrests the Archbishop of York, Mowbray, and Hastings. In Act 4, Scene 1, the rebels are dealt a blow when the Archbishop informs them that Northumberland and his forces will not be available to fight against the king's forces, which are expected to be about 30,000 strong. Westmoreland arrives and speaks at some length with the rebel leaders, the Archbishop, Mowbray, and Hastings, then accepts a document detailing their grievances. When Westmoreland is gone, the rebels debate the best course of action. Mowbray takes the view that even if peace is achieved for the present, rebels like them will never really be trusted. He argues that, quote-unquote, every slight and false derived cause, yea, every idle, nice, and wanton reason, shall to the king taste of this action. Act 4, Scene 1, lines 129 through 131. By contrast, the Archbishop insists, perhaps naively, that Henry IV will find it in his interest to ignore past injuries so as to keep the peace. He says the king will, quote-unquote, keep no telltale to his memory that may repeat and history his loss to new remembrance. Act 4, Scene 1, lines 141 through 143. That's the case, thinks the Archbishop, mainly because Henry knows he can never disentangle the complicated web of friends and enemies in his realm, and the cost of constant fighting is unsustainable. Every time he puts down a foe, the king must understand, he makes another enemy in doing so. Still, Mowbray's view is probably a better predictor of what an anxious ruler is likely to do. Such a ruler is above all afraid of losing control, so he will accept constant fighting rather than following any policy that makes him look and feel weak. Prince John meets with the rebels and accepts their conditions, saying, quote-unquote, I like them all, and do allow them well, and swear here by the honor of my blood, my father's purposes have been mistook. Act 4, Scene 1, lines 221 through 223. In other words, as he goes on to suggest, the king's wicked advisors and executors are mostly to blame if there is any bad feeling among his subjects. This is a very common rhetorical strategy on the part of wayward monarchs and their supporters. The rebels are overjoyed to hear such news and stupidly agree to disband their forces on the spot. The moment they do so, Hastings, Mowbray, and the Archbishop of York are arrested at the command of Westmoreland. Prince John says, quote-unquote, I promised you redress of these same grievances whereof you did complain, which by mine honor I will perform with a most Christian care. Act 4, Scene 1, lines 280 through 282. He will faithfully redress all grievances as listed, and he will execute the major rebels for treason. Prince John never said otherwise, so he is not, as the Archbishop claims, breaking faith. This same young sober-blooded boy doth not love me, nor a man cannot make him laugh. Falstaff accepts the surrender of the knight Colville, then tries to deflect Prince John's contemptuous witticisms before asking permission to return to London. In Act 4, Scene 2, Falstaff shows up belatedly on the field of battle, and the action is done. A knight named Colville of the Dale promptly surrenders to him because, apparently, Sir John now has a modicum of name recognition among the enemy. Prince John happens by and makes Falstaff the butt of his jokes. John taunts Sir John, quote-unquote, when everything is ended, then you come. These tardy tricks of yours will, on my life, one time or other, break some gallows back. Act 4, Scene 2, lines 24 through 26. To this rebuke, Falstaff retorts by comparing himself to no less a warrior than Julius Caesar. Quote-unquote, there, cousin, I came, saw, and overcame. Act 4, Scene 2, line 37. Prince John's interaction with Falstaff may well remind us of any number of Prince Hal's interaction with the same rascal. Structurally, this probably happens because Shakespeare sees the need to let Hal, who is about to become king, begin withdrawing in earnest from his now unacceptable mentor and companion. The next thing we hear, Falstaff's prize, Colville, is to be executed forthwith, and Prince John informs those around him that the king is alarmingly sick. When the prince exits, Falstaff grumbles about the young man, deprecating his stature and masculinity. But in the main, Sir John's complaint is, as he says, that, quote-unquote, this same young, sober-blooded boy doth not love me, nor a man cannot make him laugh. But that's no marvel. He drinks no wine. Act 4, Scene 2, lines 80 through 82. The mention of wine leads Falstaff to a soliloquy full of remarkable thoughts on the source of wit. As we might have guessed, it comes down to alcohol. Specifically, it comes down to, quote-unquote, a good sherry sack, which, quote-unquote, hath a twofold operation in it. Act 4, Scene 2, line 88 and following. The first is that it rises, he says, to the brain and dries up all the bad vapors and whatnot, and so quickens that organ. The second operation is that it heats the blood, which results in courage and skill in fighting. Why is Prince Hal valiant? It's all due to his, quote-unquote, endeavor of drinking good and good store of fertile sherry. Act 4, Scene 2, lines 109 through 110. Who can argue with Falstaff on a thing like that? Bardolph informs Sir John that, quote-unquote, the army is discharged all and gone, by which he may mean their own company or what's left of it. Act 4, Scene 2, line 115. As he has asked Prince John permission to do, Falstaff means to return home via Gloucestershire and visit Justice Shallow. Prince John, by the way, has also taken Hal's place in covering for Falstaff's deficiencies, telling him that he would give him a better report at the court than he has any business asking for. Act 4, Scene 2, lines 77 through 78. How I came by the crown, O God, forgive, and grant it may with thee in true peace live. King Henry worries that wicked friends are still ruining Prince Hal. Hearing that the rebels are done for, the king faints, and Hal takes the crown, only to see the king awaken and be filled with alarm. Hal apologizes for the misunderstanding, and father and son reconcile. In Act 4, Scene 3, King Henry, now gravely ill at Westminster Abbey, gives Thomas of Clarence some good advice on how to manage his relationship with his older brother Hal, who is soon to be king. Above all, says Henry, Thomas must be wary of crossing Hal when he is in one of his bad moods. When Clarence tells him that Hal is probably hanging around with Poins, the king has another wave of anxiety about his wayward son's character. He says, quote unquote, the blood weeps from my heart when I do shape in forms imaginary the unguided days and rotten times that you shall look upon when I am sleeping with my ancestors. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 58 through 61. Whatever will become of Henry V, the king wonders, when he is no longer there to guide the headstrong youth. Warwick expresses optimism about Hal, telling Henry that, quote-unquote, the prince but studies his companions like a strange tongue, wherein, to gain the language, 'tis needful that the most immodest word be looked upon and learnt. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 68 through 71. In other words, he takes the view that Hal himself takes. His consorting with low-born men and women, some of them rogues, is all to be recuperated and redeemed in the providential arc that the young man is tracing on his way to power. King Henry finds it hard to subscribe to such a sanguine view of his eldest son's career. Soon, Harcourt brings wonderful news, which is that, quote-unquote, the Earl Northumberland and the Lord Bardolph, with a great power of English and of Scots, are by the Shrieve of Yorkshire overthrown. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 97 through 99. Unfortunately, upon receiving this news, the dying King Henry falls into a swoon, saying, quote-unquote, now my sight fails and my brain is giddy, Oh me, come near me now, I am much ill. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 110 through 111. He sleeps, and the crown is placed upon the pillow next to his head. Hal arrives and sits next to his stricken, sleeping father, and muses on the crown as, quote-unquote, polished perturbation, golden care, that keeps the ports of slumber open wide to many a watchful night. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 154 through 156. This is in keeping with what Henry IV himself has already said about his crown and the uneasy head that wears it. Thinking his father gone forever, Hal gently picks up the crown and walks away from the chamber with it, saying, quote-unquote, my due from thee is this imperial crown, which, as immediate from thy place and blood, derives itself to me. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 172 through 174. No sooner has Hal departed the scene than King Henry awakens as if from the sleep of death and cries out for his chief ministers, quote-unquote, Warwick, Gloucester, Clarence. Act 4, Scene 3, line 179. This is a near disaster for Prince Hal, who, at best, now looks like an impatient ingrate. How does one answer a plaintive question from a dying man? Quote unquote, dost thou so hunger for mine empty chair that thou wilt needs invest thee with my honors before the hour be ripe? Asks Henry. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 224 through 226. King Henry further remonstrates with Hal, saying, quote unquote, O foolish youth, thou seek'st the greatness that will overwhelm thee. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 226 through 227. At this moment, Henry is convinced that Hal took the crown knowing he was still alive. Henry again voices his lament about Hal's and England's future, with such a wastrel on the throne, he fears, addressing England itself, quote unquote, thou wilt be a wilderness again, peopled with wolves, thy old inhabitants. Act 4, Scene 2, lines 266 through 267. Henry's explanation is that, thinking his father dead, he, quote-unquote, spake unto this crown as having sense, accusing it of contributing to that death. Act 4, Scene 3, line 287. The king is satisfied with this reasoning and at once forgives Hal for his offense against royal decorum. Henry goes on to outline first the means by which he got the crown, and then the pattern of the reign that ensued. Quote unquote, God knows, my son, by what bypaths and indirect crooked ways I met this crown, and I myself know well how troublesome it sat upon my head. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 312 through 315. Henry expresses the hope that the crown will sit easier on the head of his heir than on his own, and describes the pattern of his reign in stark terms. Quote unquote, I had many living to upbraid my gain of it by their assistances, which daily grew to quarrel and to bloodshed. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 321 through 323. Again and again he found himself having to respond boldly to the dreadful acts of rebellion launched against him. And he says, quote unquote, all my reign hath been but as a scene acting that argument. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 326 through 327. The king again expresses his belief that Henry V will find more acceptance perched at one remove from the original taking of the crown. Both times he utters this hope, it sounds like the fond hope of a dying man, which it is. Before Henry V even manages to leave the English coast for France at the beginning of his reign, he will have to defang a conspiracy against his life. Henry IV also portrays his longtime plans to retake the Holy Land for Christianity in more political terms than he has done before. Fearing the unrest of the rebellious subjects, he says, who helped to put him on the throne, the Percy clan in particular, he, quote-unquote, cut them off, and had a purpose now to lead out many to the Holy Land, lest rest and lying still might make them look too near unto my state. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 338 through 341. So while Henry seems to have sincerely wanted to go on that crusade, It was also a skillful exercise in proto-Machiavellian people management. The dying king confesses to Hal, quote unquote, "How I came by the crown, O God, forgive, and grant it may with thee in true peace live." Act 4, Scene 3, lines 347 through 348. Then, calling Warwick to him, Henry asks which room in Westminster Abbey he swooned in a while ago. The answer is Jerusalem, quote unquote. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 362. Hearing that, Henry says that many years ago, he heard a prophecy that he would die in Jerusalem, and thought that by the term was meant the actual holy city. Now he knows better and says, quote unquote, "Bear me to that chamber, there I'll lie. In that Jerusalem shall Harry die." Act 4, Scene 3, lines 367 through 368. Thanks for listening. This lecture was recorded on Thursday, October 23rd, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume genre-based format.